said, I'm one who has had a fascination with and a curiosity about the Bible from early on. So when I, the title that I got when I was thinking about what I'm going to talk about, you know, for these 2 months, this one came, was, and so what use is the Bible? I remember a time when I was with a friend, and we went to, actually, her brother's church. And we pulled up in the parking lot, and there were all these people getting out of their cars, and they all had something. And I figured out pretty quickly they were bringing their Bibles. You know, so some of them were leather-bound, some of them were, you know, pretty cloth covers, and everybody had a Bible. And confession time, it's kind of like, uh-oh. What's the service going to be like? You know, I had my own preconceived ideas of what it was going to be like. You don't see that so much. You don't see Unity people carrying Bibles every Sunday to church. But we use the Bible. Many of us use the Bible. I thought it was worthwhile just to take a look today at what use is the Bible. Really, as Unity, what do we do with it? What can it do for us? And our reactions to that, what use is the Bible to us? The reactions are often individualized. A lot depends on your experience, you know, and growing up especially. So I've already said mine was just a curious kind of thing. What is this? I remember as a child, I think I was about 10 years old, and I decided that I would start reading the Bible. And like many books, I just was opened up and started in Genesis. I got real bogged down real quick, you know, with all the begats and the you know, all of that, and so was this old and this. So that wasn't quite as successful. But people have lots of different reactions. Mine was curiosity. Some are not so positive. I've had classmates. I know people right now who have had. I think the way they describe it is they feel like they've just been beaten over the head with the Bible. You know, and sort of like, if it requires that, no, thank you. I'll go elsewhere. And sometimes they have been beaten over the head with it. There are those who get great comfort from the Bible for strength, for guidance, for comfort comes to mind often because when we're really troubled, when we're really needing answers, you know, those kinds of things are the times when we sit down if we are inclined, if we use the Bible in that sense. It can be a great resource. So a lot depends on our experiences. Unity, we use it as a tool. The Fillmores talked about, I mean, they came from a basis of Christianity, and so what the Fillmores did was they used metaphysics to make it a tool for what they called practical Christianity, which I think has always been a wonderful idea. What relevance does it have for us today? You know, so I like that. Okay, so then if we talk about the Bible isn't like a McDonald's, so that when you go to McDonald's, you pretty much know what it's going to look like, you know, what the menu is, what it's going to taste like. The Bible is very different, because when you talk about the Bible, there are all these different versions, just lots and lots of variety. That mostly what we are used to when we think about the Bible, there is, for us, the Old Testament and the New Testament. There are 66 books of the Bible. The Old Testament, I think, is 39, and the New has 27. In some books, especially the study Bibles, there is what is called the Apocrypha. And those are sacred texts that were found and, for various reasons, were not included in what is called the canonization. There was a group of people, men, that came together with the purpose of deciding what is this Bible? You know, what is the standard for this? And this is in the, like, just not that long after after Jesus died. So the first few hundred years after his death, I believe, was the canonization. And they took a look and excluded books and included books. So we have the Old Testament, we have the New Testament. And then you have these others that are very important and very meaningful, and they're included in what is called the Apocrypha. So if you see those, that's what that is. There are some who believe that God wrote the Bible. There are many, many authors of the books of the Bible. I will say that in one sense, yes, God did write the Bible. God inspired everybody who was doing it, you know, so it's God inspired. The authors, I've read some material in the book I'm going to show you in a minute, and then a really interesting book called Misquoting Jesus by Greg, I've forgotten his name, Greg Baer, something like that. He is a Bible scholar, and it's fascinating to learn what I always took for granted. If it says Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, Matthew, well, it was Matthew, the apostle, that wrote it. Not necessarily. You know, so the authors are people who may have studied with a person or wrote down what the person said. Or you know, the authors are not always named the way you would think they would be named. Paul, for example, is credited with many of the books in the New Testament. And Paul wrote a great number of those, but he didn't write all of them. Even the ones that say, you know, I'm Paul, it wasn't really Paul that wrote it. They could tell by the writing, the style of writing, that they suspect it really wasn't Paul that wrote it. So the authorship is very, very, very varied. I read maybe like several hundred authors of these various books. Okay, so you got a book that has books within it. You got lots of different authors that contributed to it. I think it's also worth mentioning that many, especially in the Old Testament, many of what is written started out as oral tradition. So these stories got passed down, you know, through eons before they were ever written down. So, and then you have the translations, lots of different translations. Some people that I've met think that King James is really the right one. It's the right translation. And what I read from this Misquoting Jesus, I think that the idea in a translation is that because there are no original sacred texts, they're long gone. So what we have are copies of copies of copies. And lots of varieties of those things. So then these scholars get together and they gather the manuscripts together and then they pore over them in great detail to figure out as best they can which one came first before the others and which are the most accurate. You know yourself that if you copy something several times, there may be mistakes. You know, there may be slight differences lots of opportunities for differences. So the scholar's job then is to come up with gathering as many as you can and coming up with what you think is the most original and most accurate. What I read was that the King James Version, the translators were not as broad in their gathering of manuscripts as they might have been. So then later translators, some of the newer, you know, later versions, other versions, draw from a much bigger pool. So they may be more accurate. So you got your King James, and you got New King James. You have American Standard. You've got Unity uses a New Revised Standard, mostly. There are regular Bibles. There are study Bibles, which have lots and lots of notes so that you can see what some of the definitions of words are. So there are all these different versions. And there are some modern, they call it modernized Bibles too. One that I got as a gift from a friend of mine is called The Message. And you can pick it up anywhere. This is in Job. The pain never lets up. But no longer. Now I'm the butt of their jokes, young ruffians, whippersnappers. You know, you don't read that in some of the others, you know, but it's like modern day translation so that it's easier to understand and put in context so that you got the modern kinds of things. All right, so you have all these different Bibles. When we take whatever Bible you end up with, whatever Bible you choose, how do you approach it? Well, there are various lenses that you can use when you're picking up a Bible to read it. This was a textbook that for me when I was in ministerial school. It's called Wisdom for a Lifetime: How to Get the Bible Off the Shelf and Into Your Hands. It's an excellent book if you are interested in Bible reading, Bible study, you know, and so forth. But it says some of the lenses, not all of them, but some of the lenses that we use when we are looking in the Bible are factual, historical, dramatic, literary, moral, allegorical, metaphysical, and metaphysical. A whole bunch of different ways that we can use it. Tackling some of those, factual. Well, there's nothing that we, if there are no original documents, there's no way we can say this is a fact. The best that can be done is to say this is a probable fact. It's very likely that this was true. So factual, only probable. Historical. As I've already mentioned, the many of the books were oral for quite a while. So yes, there's history. Is it absolutely accurate? No, maybe not. We'll see in a minute. There are other examples of other sacred scriptures that seem to say the same thing that our Bible says. So these are very ancient stories, I think, in some cases. Dramatic. I have to share with you. When I think of drama, the Old Testament is filled with drama. But one of my favorite dramatic things is Samson. Samson and Delilah. Samson was one of the judges, and he was dedicated to God even before he was born. He was born of a woman who had been barren, and an angel came and told her that she was going to bear a son, and she was not to have any drink, and he was not to after he was born because he was dedicated. So Samson came up and was dedicated. He didn't cut his hair. He didn't drink. He was really a colorful, colorful character. There's Judges chapter 14 is about Samson getting married. Samson saw a Philistine woman that he liked, and he went to his parents and said, "I want that woman." And they tried to talk him out of it because the Philistines were the oppressors at that time of Israel. Couldn't you find a local girl, you know, or someone from, you know? I'm paraphrasing greatly here. And he said, "Nope, that's who I want." He says, "Get her for me because she pleases me." So you kind of get the impression that Samson was a spoiled, pampered. He was used to getting what he wanted, for sure. "Get her for me." Okay, so then it goes on. They agreed. Samson went down with his father and mother to Timnah. I guess this is the town where he had seen this woman. And he was there. And he says, when he came to the vineyards of Timnah, suddenly a young lion roared at him. The Spirit of the Lord rushed on him, and he tore the lion apart barehanded, as one might tear apart a kid, a goat, not a child. But he did not tell his father or his mother what he had done. So he talked with the woman. She pleased him. When he returned to marry her, he turned aside to face this carcass, turned aside to see the carcass of the lion, and there was a swarm of bees in the body of the lion and honey. He scraped it out into his hands and went on eating the honey. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some of it to them, and they ate it. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey from the carcass of the lion. There was a feast, a wedding feast. Apparently it went on for 7 days. When the people saw him, they brought 30 companions to be with him. Apparently there was a tradition of giving garments or something. So Samson said to them, "Let me now put a riddle to you. If you can explain it to me within the 7 days and find it out, I will give you 30 linen garments and 30 festal garments. But if you cannot explain it to me, then you shall give me 30 linen garments and 30 festal garments." So they said, "Ask your riddle." And it was this: out of the eater came something to eat, out of the strong came something sweet. That was their riddle that they were supposed to solve. So they worked on it, couldn't come up with anything. After 3 days, they went to the bride, you know, one of the Philistine woman who was his bride, and said, "Coax him to tell you the answer, because we're not figuring this out." So she went to him and said, she cried, you know, and said, "You must not love me. Don't tell me this." And he resisted, but she nagged him. So finally on the seventh day, it says that, then he finally told her what it was. She went to the people, her people, and told them. So then they had the answer. And his reaction is dramatic. he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have found out my riddle." Then the Spirit of the Lord rushed on him, and he went down to Ashkelon. He killed 30 men of the town, took their spoil, and gave the festal garments to those who had explained the riddle. In hot anger, he went back to his father's house. And Samson's wife was given to his companion, who had been his best man. Talk about... I know. Pretty dramatic. This Samson was a real character. And you should read more. You know, there's lots. There's lots and lots of drama, you know, and many, almost everybody has heard about Abraham and being guided to offer his son, you know, Isaac, and he didn't have to. But there's lots of drama in the Old Testament. Literary, that's another lens. The Bible is one of the most amazing books of literature. And I've read that in several places. When you think of literature, poetry and prose and all of that, the Bible has that. I'm not going to read a lot, but I wanted to just... the Psalms, lots and lots in there. Just a couple lines from Psalm 42. "As a deer longs for flowing streams, so my soul longs for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and behold the face of God? My tears have been my food day and night, while people say to me continually, 'Where is your God?'" You know, very beautiful poetry kind of thing. Psalms are like that. The Proverbs are intended to be kind of like wisdom, pieces of wisdom, and there's lots and lots of those. Proverbs: "A wise child makes a glad father, but a foolish child is a mother's grief. Treasures gained by wickedness do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. The Lord does not let the righteous go hungry, but he thwarts the craving of the wicked," you know, and on and on. So we have poetry in the Psalms, we've got guidance, wisdom writings in Proverbs. Song of Solomon. Have you ever taken a look at Song of Solomon? It's kind of racy. just a little bit there. And I had to look kind of hard for stuff I wanted to say from up here, you know. So, okay, this is in chapter 4. "How beautiful you are, my love, how very beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair..." I'm not sure about whether I would think this part coming up as a compliment. "Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead." I think that might have been a compliment at the time. It loses something in the timing. So, "Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes. Your lips are like a crimson thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate." The whole... the whole book of Song of Solomon is like a bridegroom and a bride speaking back and forth. It's very interesting. Literary. There is a lot just in terms of literature in here. Moral. I won't read it, but I found a story. You're familiar with it, I'm sure. The young man who asked, "What do I need to do to enter into the kingdom of heaven?" And first, Jesus explains to him, he needs to follow the commandments, and he says, "Which ones?" And Jesus tells him and runs down the list of the ones that are important. And the young man says, "I do those." And he said, "Well, good, okay. Then go and sell all of your possessions, and then give the money to the poor, and come and follow me." And the young man hangs his head and turns around and leaves because he can't do that. So there are moral stories of moral learnings in here. The allegories, and parables are some of the most important tools that Jesus used in teaching. So there are lots and lots of allegorical and metaphorical kinds of things, and of course metaphysical. That's what we do here much of the time when we're using the Bible. Often we look at the metaphysical meanings because that has relevance for us today and in our world. If we can, you know, what does this mean to me, kind of thing. So we use metaphysical too. The Bible is sacred scripture. Unity honors all paths, and there are many, many sacred texts. In our own Bible, I've already mentioned the Apocrypha. There was a discovery, I think, in the 40s, the Nag Hammadi Library. There were sacred texts that were found in a cave, and so there are these sacred texts. Each of the major religions, though, has its own sacred text, and some of these are pretty amazing in what they say. Hindu, which is just an ancient religion, has Vedas, I think, and then within those, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing it right, the Upanishad, or within those. Listen to just a couple of lines from one of those. "Now the light which shines above this heaven, above all the worlds, above everything, in the highest worlds not excelled by any other worlds, that is the same light which is within man. There is this visible proof of this light when we thus perceive by touch the warmth in the body." So here's something that way back, was saying the same thing that Unity teaches. The Buddhists have, people would write down the teachings of the Buddha, and so there's lots and lots written. Those are their sacred texts. The Taoists have Tao Te Ching that they use. In Zoroastrianism, which I don't think is very big anymore, but there was an entry that I found fascinating. This was a long time ago. This was it's a religion of ancient Persia. "Of Ahura Mazda's creatures of the world, the first was the sky, the second water, the third earth, the fourth plants, the fifth animals, the sixth mankind." Sound like anything that we're familiar with? If you go to Genesis, you know, we've got the same kind of creation stories. Very interesting. Islam has the Quran. And then there are newer sacred texts. Some of the, like Mary Baker Eddy for Christian Science wrote a book, and they use that. And I think it was, she kind of like froze it so that it will never be changed, or can never be changed. So they have sacred texts. The Mormons have text that was his name Joseph Baker? Does that sound right? Joseph? Yes. So I couldn't remember his name, but so he got, Yeah, yes, thank you. I'm so computer-oriented, downloaded. was revealed through him, and so then the Mormons have that text that is newer, that is sacred to them. Well, I find it interesting, don't you, that there are all these, I mean, forever, it just seems like mankind has always had sacred texts of some kind. We have Bible and others have that. Why? Well, something that I think that we, humankind, I think, wants to understand. They want to understand, we want to understand, why are we here? What are we to do? And some of those really deep core answers, we turn to sacred text for those. And some of those stories, the stories of creation, all of those in the various forms that they come, answer some of those deep, deep questions. But I found something in here that really resonated for me, and I think this really summarizes, I believe, why do we keep going back to these sacred texts? Why do we keep trying to learn about the Bible or whatever it is that is ours? In here, I read the sentence that says, we want and we need a more permanent awareness of God's presence. I think that is so true. We come here every week because we help each other remember that truth, that we are one with God. People everywhere, I think, want to know, want to remember the permanence of God, oneness with God. And the Bible helps us with that. What use is the Bible? It is a great help. Let's take a few moments then to connect with that source, to be one with our Creator, what we call God. So I invite you to close your outer eyes if you haven't already. Take a deep breath and release. We become still. We take these moments, and we take moments during the week to just put aside and turn away from our outer lives, to just be still. Sometimes our minds want to keep on chattering. It's called monkey mind. And if we are experiencing that, we can purposely put our minds on watching our breath, noticing the breath in and out, noticing sensation. We just focus on stillness. And when we have stilled ourselves, body and mind, we become open, willing, receptive to that connection, to the recognition, to the awareness, the realization of our oneness. There are other ways to feel the connection. Often when we are in a creative flow, writing or painting or crocheting or whatever creative outlet you use, we often find ourselves at one with that force, that power, that divinity. And purposely setting aside time like this to be still, allows us to connect . Sometimes we're not even aware that anything is happening. Often it feels like nothing is happening. It's not necessarily true that we're going to have amazing ideas immediately. We're going to have sensations or feelings. Mostly we sit and we're quiet. But what we discover is when we do this on a regular basis, we notice that we are feeling peaceful and calm much more often. We may well notice and feel that we are more present. We're more grounded. Better able to take a step back and observe what's going on in our lives and not necessarily be a part of it. We are one with our Creator. If we were to scoop up a cup of ocean and ask, is this the ocean? Yes. Is it all of the ocean? No. Each of us is God in expression. Are we all of God? No. But we are God in expression right here, expressing as us. So when we become still, we can experience that oneness, that divine. And just like plugging in an outlet into the wall, when we are connected to Source, good flows. The light comes on. We are peaceful. We are love. We are health. We are wisdom. We get to be the channels, the expression of these things in the world. And so when we sit in silence, we find ourselves renewed, made calm, strengthened, comforted, inspired. As we do each week, let us take a few moments now in silence to simply be at one with the divine in the silence. We are grateful for these times of connection, of communion. Grateful that we realize, know the truth, that we are loved beyond compare, that we have been created in the image and likeness of our Creator. We have been created in the image of love and peace and joy and prosperity and health and wisdom and joy. We are grateful for this time of fellowship with our Unity Church family. Grateful for these times of remembering. Grateful for the support that we have and that we feel and we receive and we give each week. but especially grateful for the connection and our awareness of that connection. So as we begin to bring this time of connection, of communion to a close, we want to acknowledge the gratitude that we feel. Grateful for this oneness, grateful for our awareness. And we carry that gratitude with us as we come together, as we do each week, to pray the words that our way shower taught us, our Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.